Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And joining me this week is Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter at Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Hey, great to be here.
Ohio Capital Journal reporter, Megan Henry. Welcome back, Megan.
Good morning.
And Hannah News Service reporter, Danny Eldridge. Welcome, Danny.
Good to be here.
So Republican Vivek Ramaswamy launches his campaign for governor today. He officially filed the paperwork on Saturday. The Cincinnati native who lives in suburban Columbus would be quite a contrast to the current opponent in the current occupant of the governor's mansion, Mike DeWine, who is term limited. Ramaswamy is 39. He's never held elected office before, but he did run for president back in 2024. So, Jeremy, give us a rundown of what Ramaswamy is rolling out with this week to launch this campaign.
Well, it's a poorly kept secret that he is going to run for governor. He is going to...
Is it still supposed to be a secret? Oh, no.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Cat's out of the bag to all your listeners. It's interesting because Ramaswamy up until now has mostly focused on federal issues. Even if you go to his Twitter now, you know, you see him mostly focusing on federal issues from a federal bureaucracy, because obviously he was involved with the DOGE government efficiency initiative that's now making headlines around the country. He, as you said, ran for president. So it's going to be really interesting to see. And he hasn't made a whole lot of, you know, hat tipping or eye winking ahead of time about what his platform is going to be specifically for Ohio. Like, what is he going to do in terms of Ohio state budgets, Ohio education, Ohio Medicaid, things like transportation? What's he going to do about highways? You know, that inflation is making it harder to fund our highways. What's he going to do about that? That's the kind of stuff that we're going to have to see, because he up until now has focused mostly on federal issues.
Yeah. And Megan, what do you expect for his big announcement? It's in Cincinnati. Is it going to be like a speech?
I would assume so. Yes. So he's got the speech in Cincinnati, and then he kicks off this statewide tour, really, just going around different counties throughout the state to really get to know folks, it seems like, and pitch his platform, like Jeremy was talking about. So yeah, curious what all he'll hit up on tonight as far as his experience is kind of somewhat limited when it comes to politics. Of course, he ran for president, and there was some rumors or speculation that maybe he would be the Senate pick for Governor DeWine, but that, of course, did not happen, and now here we are today. So, yeah, I would expect to see a speech of some sort, and then I'm not sure if we'll see, you know, policy platforms being spelled out tonight, but I would hope in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, Danny, I wonder if he'll just make the fancy speeches, maybe have, you know, music, maybe some balloons, but probably won't take questions from the press, if you had to guess, right?
I mean, I'd be surprised if he took questions, but, I mean, I think it might be interesting to see if he, like what Jeremy said, if he comes up with any, if he talks about any of his state level policies, because at this point it's mostly federal stuff, and it's, you know, criticizing the Biden administration is a little bit different than criticizing the DeWine administration. You know, it would be a little bit of a different perspective. I'll be interested to see what he talks about.
Yeah, and so it's tonight, right, Jeremy? It's kind of like it starts this evening with an event, right?
Well, he's starting like any good campaign would for statewide office. He's going to start in Cincinnati and then come to New Albany. Then he's going to go to Toledo and then the Cleveland area tomorrow. And so the big thing for Ramaswamy is, it's interesting. So he's entering what's effectively now going to be a two-person race now. We'll see if more people jump in. We can talk about that in a second. So Ramaswamy against Attorney General Dave Yost. And they have opposite things they need to do now. Yost has been, he's run for statewide office four times, twice as auditor, twice as AG. And he's been hitting all these Lincoln Day dinners, and he, you know, has all these relationships he's built up with, like, local county Republican chairs and all that. But he needs now to raise money and raise his name ID among kind of the rank and file voters. And Ramaswamy is the opposite effect. He's been on Fox News, and he's made the circuit of national media, and a lot of people know who he is. He has strong name ID, especially among Republicans. But the question now is, can he get and build these personal connections and relationships around Ohio? And that requires him to physically go to all these places, you know, the Williams counties of the state, and actually introduce himself and make his case to Republican voters, because, you know, obviously he's running now in the Republican primary.
And Megan, do you think that's how Dave Yost will take his campaign, to say that Ramaswamy doesn't know Ohio or doesn't know how to be a politician in Ohio?
I'm not sure, because like Jeremy was saying, Yost has been a politician or has been in the state office for quite some time. So I think that could be something that he tries to hit up on, just like the maybe not as much name recognition as a former presidential candidate has here in Ohio. But potentially, I do think that, yeah, Yost would be smart to go across the state to try to meet voters and get his platform out there as well.
Well, and you know, and Dave Yost has already raised, you know, more than $1 million. I mean, he's in decent shape financially, and he's no stranger to fundraising. You know, and another thing he could talk about is, you know, he's been a state auditor. You know, he's been what, you know, DOGE says they're doing, you know, in auditing the federal government. He can talk about his actual experience being an auditor for 8 years and then being attorney general. So I think he'll probably talk up his experience and Vivek Ramaswamy's lack of experience as reasons to support him.
I wonder how long it'll be, like how much President Trump will have influence. You know, when will President Trump be here, you know, supporting him, and how much that will impact the Yost campaign.
And that's the thing. That's the wild card. If you look at both in Ohio, especially, and around the country, it's really been campaigns are now increasingly tailoring their message to one guy. And it's President Trump, who's been sort of the kingmaker, especially in Ohio. Just ask J.D. Vance, Bernie Moreno. And if you look at what Vivek has done, he's kind of tailored, already started to lay the groundwork for making that case. Donald Trump in the past few years has started to not endorse right away. Hmm. He'll look at the race, he'll let it play out, he'll see who's ahead, and then he'll weigh in. That's what happened with J.D. Vance and Bernie Moreno, both of whom ran in contested primaries, but Trump waited, you know, kind of late in the race to jump in there. And so Vivek, his team's started putting out polling, showing him ahead. He's hired a bunch of people who have strong connections, particularly to J.D. Vance, now the vice president. And so he's starting to lay the groundwork not only to have the message for Trump and his political team, but also to hire the people who have those connections to make those points in a way that it'll be heard.
Now, let's talk about someone who perhaps has more name recognition than Ramaswamy, and that's our new lieutenant governor, Jim Tressel. What if he actually does decide to run? Do you think that he has... I mean, he obviously has a lot of clout in the state.
Yeah, that also, to use Jeremy's word, is also kind of the wild card that we could see play out in this as well. It was a very interesting choice by Governor Mike DeWine recently to have Tressel become the lieutenant governor. So, yes, that absolutely could be a factor if Tressel decides to run. And he would be a very different candidate. He also is new to politics, so we're not quite sure what his policy also is on these different issues. But that could be definitely someone who we could see throw their hat in the race as well.
Yeah, Danny, Jim Tressel has been lieutenant governor for all of, this is week two. Do you think that he has any interest in running for governor?
I mean, he wouldn't rule it out. So, yeah. But, you know, and also he's talked about running for office, it seems like, for years, and he's, you know, he's 72. So if he's going to run for governor, he probably needs to do it pretty soon. So I would... you know, we'll see what he does. But he hasn't announced anything, and I don't know if he's going to do anything soon. But we'll see. There's still time.
Well, it's interesting, Jeremy, because Jim Tressel kind of came out of nowhere, surprised everyone. Like Mike DeWine surprised everyone with this pick. So, do you think Mike DeWine had that in mind, where he was like, "Who could?" I mean, I don't know if DeWine likes Ramaswamy. Or Dave Yost, either of them. So, was DeWine trying to throw a third guy in there?
And that's the $64,000 question here.
Oh boy,
that's what's underpinning most of the speculation about Jim Tressel, which is that there's an assumption, right or wrong, like you said, that DeWine doesn't want Vivek Ramaswamy to be governor because they have very different styles. Ramaswamy is much more like a brash populist, and DeWine's more of an old school Republican who's kind of keep your head down, you know, focus on the policy issues, that sort of thing. So whether that is right or not, I get the impression that Jim Tressel is going to sink in and try to actually understand his current job and then look for an opening if there is an opening where, I don't know, for whatever reason, Yost or Ramaswamy tank for some reason, he might jump in. I mean, we're pretty early in this. Like, we've got, what, 15 months before the primary? And the only reason this got accelerated beyond where it normally is because of that Senate announcement where John Husted, who was going to be DeWine's heir apparent, ended up getting appointed to the Senate. So now there's an opening. So the question now is, oh, who's DeWine's political heir going to be? Oh, we just named Jim Tressel. It must be him, right? Well, maybe DeWine decides I'm not going to have a political heir. And then we're going to have to see how that plays out from there and what role, if any, DeWine will have in trying to influence who his successor will be.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. With us is Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, Ohio Capital Journal reporter Megan Henry, and Danny Eldridge with Hannah News Service. Let's talk about the Democrats for just a second as it comes to the governor's race. Right now, we have former Ohio Department of Health Director Amy Acton running what I feel like is a very quiet campaign. Megan, would you say it's quiet?
Yes. Aside from her initial announcement as governor, it's been pretty quiet. She hasn't made any real appearances or, as far as I know, gone on like a or launched a statewide tour or announced a statewide tour. So, yeah, it's been quiet. I've gotten emails from her press team. But as far as that, I know she's done some interviews with different media organizations and TV stations. But aside from that, it has been fairly quiet.
Now, do you think, Danny, do you think that there will be any other Democrats that will jump in? Has any name been floated here or there?
You know, I mean, I would be surprised if no other Democrat joins the race. But I haven't heard a lot of talk about anyone. I mean, I was reading about Zach Klein, but he might run for mayor, not, you know, not governor. So,
the Columbus City Attorney.
City Attorney, Zach Klein, I should have said. Yes.
So, but Jeremy, how about Congressman Tim Ryan? He was on Real Time with Bill Maher at some point last week, and he didn't say no when asked about his future plans.
He didn't say no, and his name has been talked about. Of course, he ran against J.D. Vance in 2022, and after, you know, he almost became a punchline for every cycle. Tim Ryan would be talked about as running for something, and then he finally ran 2022. He's from the Youngstown area, but now he lives near Columbus. He has changed his life a lot since leaving Congress. Now he's a lobbyist for crypto and for natural gas, and he's an advocate of crypto. And so he's been talked about, and he might have a lot of support. The big thing, the big person, of course, that people are looking at is what will Sherrod Brown do?
Yeah.
And since he got defeated and thrown out of office last November, I think he has the luxury of waiting to make a decision, even into like the summer, about whether he's going to run for governor or Senate. He might not run for anything. And I think a lot of that talk is based more off of Democrats hoping that he would run for something than actual intel that he might run for something. But if he runs, regardless of what he runs for, I think you'll see him probably clear the race of most, if not all, of his opponents. It'll go from there.
All right. Well, let's turn from the governor's race because, you know, as Jeremy pointed out, it is far away. So you said 15 months till the primary, right?
May 2026.
All right. Yes. So we have some time. So we'll put a pin in that for now. Let's talk a little bit about Elon Musk's government efficiency department and its continuing of federal spending cuts, going agency to agency, laying off workers. Megan, what's your sense of the impact that's having right now in Ohio?
It seems like it's causing a lot of confusion. I would say it's overwhelming, this kind of uncertainty among federal workers, not just in Ohio, but nationwide. But as far as the impact on Ohio, I think it just, yeah, this leads to a lot of like questions of what this could mean for Ohio. I know that there's the NASA up in Cleveland. I don't know if, Jeremy, if you could speak to that or any other.
If they've had impacts.
The Glenn Research Center,
yes,
you mean?
Yes.
I think it's just up in the air for just everyone right now. And a lot of what they're doing now is doing these funding reviews. In addition to the layoffs that DOGE is doing. So the question is, even if it's not just direct federal layoffs, are you going to have these grants that places like the Glenn Center rely on, are they going to dry up too? And there's just a lot of uncertainty right now.
And there's a lot of talk about federal funding for hospitals too. I mean, there's all kinds of research projects going on at Nationwide Children's, Ohio State. They're all federally funded. And, you know, can they continue? Will they continue? Is the money there? There's Republicans in Congress have been largely silent since President Trump has moved into office. However, Republican U.S. Rep. Troy Balderson from Central Ohio area described President Trump's flurry of executive orders as, quote, getting out of control. He was talking to the Westerville area Chamber of Congress at a lunch Chamber of Commerce at a luncheon. And, he's one of the few people who said anything, and all he said was it's getting a little out of control. Do you think that other members of Congress there's probably some rumblings where he's basically saying President Trump is doing things that Congress should be doing?
Right. Yes, I'm sure there are some rumblings and discussions behind closed doors. So I think this was kind of surprising to see someone say that in a public space, in a public venue. If I remember correctly, it seems like he kind of walked back his comment later that night on X when an article about his comments was made. I forget exactly what he said, but it seemed like he was trying to kind of couch his previous statements.
Yes.
So I think just the fear of retaliation or how this could affect.
If you're a Republican in Congress, you don't want to get on President Trump's bad side.
Exactly. So. Yes.
All right. Well, coming up, we are going to talk about budget proposals, school funding, and we'll talk about Medicaid here in Ohio. That is when the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Danny Eldridge, reporter for HANA News Service, and Jeremy Pelzer, political reporter for Cleveland.com. So I mentioned before the break that we were going to talk a little bit about Medicaid. So Megan, more than 400 people submitted comments opposing Ohio's proposed Medicaid work requirements. Can you tell me about these work requirements? What would they do?
Yes. So it was in, they were enacted through Ohio's previous budget back in 2023 that would require the state Medicaid department to reapply with the federal government under the new presidential administration, which is now the Trump administration, for permission to impose work requirements for adult Medicaid health coverage recipients. And so there was a comment period that the Ohio Department of Medicaid did, and overwhelming majority of those folks are against these work requirements. There were some in favor. About 5% of the comments were in favor of the requirements. Some were mixed of, I'm not quite sure if I support or oppose them. I need more information. But an overwhelming majority of folks submitted comments saying how this would negatively impact their lives or family members' lives.
Now, was there, along with the work requirements, does this impact a certain age? Because there's a lot of people who receive Medicaid who are, elderly. They're getting it for like caregiving and that kind of thing. We're not talking about that. We're talking about other people who get Medicaid.
Go for it. This would be for everyone, not just Medicaid expansion. Yeah, because as you said, there's two kinds of people, or two groups of people that get Medicaid. There's one is if you're lower income, and then if you are disabled, or if you have a variety of other eligible in a number of other ways. But so there's about 3 million people who get Medicaid right now in Ohio. And if these work requirements require anyone under age 55 to have to work at least 20 hours a week unless they have some exemption, like they go to school or they have a drug addiction treatment program, things like that.
Okay. And I did want to mention a little bit about Medicaid when it comes at the federal level, because it is being talked about at the federal level of pulling back on some federal funding that the states receive when it comes to Medicaid. What does that look like for Ohio's budget if that happens federally?
I think Jeremy wrote about that a little bit, but I was reading.
There's two things. So right now there's talking in Congress about in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
Cutting costs and mm-hmm. cutting spending. And one of the ways they're looking at is Medicaid work requirements, but also cutting the share that the feds give to states to mm-hmm. pay for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And right now in Ohio, it's 90-10. So the federal government pays 90% and the state pays 10%. And that initially was 100% for Medicaid expansion, but now it's 90-10. Mm-hmm. For other Medicaid, like the disabled, et cetera, it's about roughly 2/3 of every dollar spent. The point is, if you were there's a point in the budget, there's language in the current state budget from Governor Mike DeWine saying that if that is reduced even by 1% more, Medicaid expansion in Ohio will go away entirely. That was authorized rather controversially by then Governor John Kasich, who kind of circumvented the legislature and had it passed through this board called the Controlling Board and back in 2013. And right now there's about, out of, I think, 3 million people, there are, I think, 771,000 right now Ohioans who get Medicaid expansion because they're low income. And that would automatically just go away if the feds reduce that, as they're talking about. Now, all this is speculative because there's two things that this is predicated on. One is that Congress will actually, and Trump will sign something that reduces that share for the feds, and that Ohio's state budget will pass with this language intact, because Ohio already can do this, but this would make it mandatory and on like a trigger language.
Right.
So both those things have to happen.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot in the state budget, and Medicaid is a large portion of the state budget. So we'll just have to wait and see how this all plays out. Right. Because there's the state has to kind of wait for the federal government to do something simultaneously while passing their own budget, right?
Yes, that is correct. Yes.
Megan, you also wrote about how Ohio schools could be impacted if the federal government does dismantle the federal Department of Education. Ohio schools receive about 10% of their funding from the federal government. So do you know who will be most impacted? What would happen if that 10% does go away?
Yeah, so there's lots of questions around this, and this is all, this is speculative at the moment. It would take, although Trump has said he wants to dismantle the Department of Education, it would take Congress to actually do that. But yes, there is a big question of this federal funding. You know, would the funding, just the 10% that most school districts in Ohio receive, some do receive more, but it just kind of depends on the needs of the district. But it's a question of, will this federal funding just go away? Would it go to a different department that a different agency in the government would have control over? And if so, what would that look like? But as far as who would be affected the most by this federal funding potentially going away or just changing would be students with disabilities and also lower income school districts across the state. They receive, Title I, school districts receive Title I funding. That's for students school districts that have lower income students. So the more lower income students you have, then the more Title I funding, in theory, you would receive. And then there's also IDA funding.
IDA? What is IDA?
It is, let me pull that up real quick. I don't want to give you bad information.
Oh, that's okay. I don't know what alphabet for that. Yeah.
Essentially, it's for students with disability, mm-hmm. just making sure that they also are able to receive a free education as well. And so that is federal funding. And so it's kind of a question mark of what would happen to that funding.
Yeah. So for public schools to have the services needed in the school so that these students with disabilities can attend class.
Correct.
Correct. Yes. So the federal government helps school districts be able to pay for the aides or mm-hmm. the accessible classrooms or that kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. I talked to some special education coordinators in school districts across Ohio, and they're, you know, they have questions about what this could mean for their jobs. You know, would the funding for their salary, you know, disappear? I talked to one special ed coordinator, and she's not only worried about her current job, but also for her students who are benefits, who benefit mm-hmm. from this funding. And so she's worried about it as a parent and as an educator.
It's another one of those remains to be seen things, because if Congress does have to dismantle it, will they? If Donald Trump wants them to, we have to wait and see. Yes, a lot of things can be said, but it's a matter of whether they'll be done. I think at the moment we'll move on to an Ohio bill. The controversial bathroom bill becomes law tomorrow. So the law requires students to use the bathroom and locker room of the gender they were assigned to at birth. Does the bill do anything else besides that? I feel like I can't remember if there was more to the bill than just the bathrooms.
The bathrooms is mm-hmm. the big thing. Also locker rooms. I think you mentioned that. But also overnight accommodations for the K-12 sector. So if there's a school trip, for instance, if you go to, you know, Washington, D.C. for 8th grade class trip or something like along those lines, it would affect the overnight accommodations. But the bathrooms are the big thing in the bill.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of different opinions on this, but the bill did pass, so it is going into effect. It applies to public and private K-12 schools and colleges and universities. The Columbus City School Board voted last week to rescind its policy, which would have kept the existing transgender bathroom policy. They did this because there was a threat of a lawsuit from Attorney General Dave Yost. I'm not sure if any of you covered that with Columbus City Schools.
I did not cover it, but I followed along
yeah.
With the Columbus Dispatch's coverage, how they had a transgender bathroom policy in place. Mm-hmm. And if the policy basically was not rescinded, which they had discussed at a previous school board meeting, and that was reported, then Dave Yost issued a letter to them basically saying that if you do not rescind your policy, you will be violating state law and there will be repercussions from that. So this past week at the school board meeting, Columbus City Schools rescinded their policy so that they have no policy as far as I understand, so that they will be in compliance with state law.
Yeah, nearly a dozen students from schools across the district spoke up during that school board meeting. Here's a high school junior and transgender student, Austin Tapp, who told the Columbus School Board that he thinks the law is unenforceable.
And the simple fact of the matter is, unless they are willing to spend money on hiring people to enforce such a law, which will not happen, then so long I will be able to use the restroom in peace, which truly that's all we can ask for.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, there's a point there. Who's going to be checking in on each individual school and each individual bathroom?
Well, also, the bathroom bill, or I guess the bathroom law now, didn't have any penalties or enforcement provisions in it. So it relies on, like, Dave Yost trying to enforce it. But then also, we're also in state budget season, and the House Finance Chair, Brian Stewart, actually tweeted, like, threatening to intentionally violate state law during budget season. And then he posted a gif of Donald Trump doing his eyebrow raise, you know. So, I mean,
okay.
If you're so
very threatening, yes.
There's ways to enforce this other than just slapping criminal penalties on someone. And that usually involves, like, threat of legal action or, in this case, money.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides, and with us is Ohio Capital Journal reporter Megan Henry, Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, and Danny Eldridge from Hannah News Service. And just to talk a little more about Governor DeWine's budget, it is seeking $103 million in public school funding cuts. So the legislature's nonpartisan research agency has weighed in on the governor's budget proposal, but this does not seem like a good move for traditional public schools. What did anyone find in their investigation of the budget when it comes to school funding?
So first of all, big caveat here is that these numbers, these projections are revised many times. Mm-hmm. So I would not be surprised if, you know, in the short to medium term, we get another set of numbers. At the same time, yeah, like you said, it would cut $103 million for traditional public schools, and it would provide about costs for charter schools and voucher programs would go up above $500 million. And part of that is because, of course, the state has dramatically expanded eligibility for vouchers mm-hmm. For private schools. And You know, it also reflects, too, if you when my colleague Laura Hancock asked the DeWine administration about this, you know, spokesman Dan Tierney said you're seeing students move out of school districts and they're moving sometimes to private schools thanks to the voucher eligibility expansion. And so if they're being cuts, it's not because they're, you know, intentionally taking money away, but there's just fewer students to fund and that results in these cuts.
Danny, have you been following any of this money when it comes to public schools versus private schools and where the money's going in the budget?
I mean, I haven't covered that super closely. I do know that the budget, you know, provides more funding for vouchers than it has, which has been, you know, consistently what Republicans have been doing over the last several years.
Yeah, one thing that's interesting is the numbers for the voucher program. It isn't causing public schools necessarily to jump to private schools. It's not causing students in public schools to move to private schools. It's just more so subsidizing students who are already in private schools. Is that what you found, Megan?
So far, yes. I think it'll be interesting to look at the data year over year to see, you know, if there is a decline in students attending public schools and going to private schools. But yes, we do. That is what we have seen so far, is that it seems to, there hasn't been this massive exodus from public schools into private schools. Instead, it seems like it's been more so students who are currently attending private schools who are now tapping into the voucher funds. And that's not to say that there aren't some students who probably, you know, went from a public school to now attending a private school. But I think we haven't seen these major numbers yet.
So to give some context to this, over the past few years, lawmakers and the governor have dramatically increased funding for public schools. But in the past few years, the state has been in a better financial shape than it's been in decades, mostly because of billions in federal coronavirus aid and higher than expected tax revenue. And so the state has been able to both dramatically expand vouchers and give more money to public schools. They haven't had to make that choice. And now we're coming back down to earth. The coronavirus money is being spent, and where tax revenues are not increasing as the level they were. And so we are now having to make decisions, kind of more traditional decisions, about which priority not have our cake and eat it to.
Well, the next thing on my agenda to talk about is the marijuana bill, but we're going to save that for after a break. So this is the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides, and I'm Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is All Sides and the weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is an hour where we catch up on the political news of the week and preview the week ahead. And still with us is Jeremy Pelzer, political reporter for Cleveland.com, Ohio Capital Journal reporter Megan Henry, and from Hannah News Service, Danny Eldridge. And I wanted to move on to talk about marijuana policy. If I can find it in my script. Listeners, I had a huge technical issue during the break, but now we're all fixed. Okay. So, Megan, you have been covering Senator Huffman's bill that would, this is Senator Huffman, Steve Huffman, as opposed to Matt Huffman, who's the House Speaker. Anyway, lots of Huffmans. Okay. Are they no relation? Do you know?
They're cousins.
Oh, okay. Great. Okay. So Senator Huffman, his bill would make major changes to recreational marijuana law, the law that was passed by voters. It would do everything from change the maximum potency levels from 90% to 70%. It was going to deal with tax increases, but they kind of moved that out. So, Megan, why don't you give us an update on this marijuana bill?
Yeah, you hit up on some of the big stuff for sure. Another major thing that this bill would do that has the opponents have been very vocal about is limiting home grow. So currently, the way the law is currently written, folks can have up to 12 plants grow up to 12 plants at your house, and this bill would cut that in half down to 6. And so opponents are very critical of that. They want to be able to grow their own, and some are interested in potentially having their own business and selling it, their product. So that's a big
that whole idea of how many plants you have in your house. That kind of ties me back to what we were talking about in the last segment with the bathroom bill of who's going to police this. So who is someone going to go to your house and count your plants? I don't foresee that happening.
You know, that's a good question. Yeah, the enforcement aspect is kind of missing at this point.
But I guess if you got in trouble for something, then they count your plants, that could be another charge against you if you have too many.
Right. Yes.
Sure.
So that's a big thing. It would also do a couple other things. It would combine the state's medical and recreational marijuana program under the Division of Cannabis Control. They're currently separate. It would also require marijuana to be transported in the trunk of a car while traveling. So that would just cause limits on the delivery aspect of marijuana. As you mentioned, the potency, it would also cap the active dispensaries at 350. There are currently about 130 dispensaries. And so opponents of this bill are saying that they would just continue to go up to Michigan if a bill like this were to go into effect.
Devoted an entire hour to this topic last week on All Sides, and one of the representatives from OCAN, which is the Ohio Cannabis Organization, I can't remember exactly what OCAN stands for, but they are pro recreational marijuana. And he was telling me that he wanted me not to say the 90% to 70% was potency levels. He wanted me to say purity levels, because he was saying that it has to do, especially for medical marijuana patients, they really care about the purity. And so Michigan has 90% still. So he said that that was going to impact the purity. So, Danny, what are you seeing with this bill? Do you think where what's going to happen to it this week?
So, it was scheduled for a vote last Wednesday, but the chairman of the committee, Senator Christina Rogner, she canceled the hearing. It's not clear if it was because there wasn't, they want to work on the bill more, or if it was because Steve Huffman was out of town. That also probably went into it. But
yeah, we invited Steve Huffman to be on the show that we had last week, and he's a doctor, and he was part of an emergency response team, and he had to go to Kentucky because of the flooding, which I was fair reason, right? So I would say fair reason, but that they didn't vote on his bill while he was gone. Yeah.
So, but it is starred for a possible vote on the agenda this week. During the hearing, as Megan said, there was a lot of criticism from advocates. A lot of veterans were there criticizing it for, a lot of veterans use it for PTSD, and they've been growing it themselves and sharing it with other veterans to help them. And one thing this bill does is it would make any sharing illegal.
I didn't know
that's
that
actually
part.
A pretty big change. And another change in there would make it illegal to have any marijuana that is not homegrown or bought in Ohio. So potentially, if people did want to go to Michigan because it's cheaper, they could be pulled over by the Ohio Patrol or somebody else, some other law enforcement, and actually cited for having marijuana that's not legal. Right now, it's possession is legal, matter where it's from. So that's another large change that is in that bill.
And Megan, do you see the bill passing this week? Will they bring it back up? Do you think it's going to pass out of the Senate?
I think that's fair to say that, yes, it's up for a committee vote Wednesday morning. There's no testimony. It says on the schedule, no testimony. So I'm assuming it'll just pass out of committee and go to the full Senate later that afternoon, where I would expect it to pass out of the Senate.
Do you expect any changes between now and Friday, I guess? Or do you think they'll send it to the House for other changes?
It's funny. Rob McCauley, Senate President Rob McCauley, was asked that. He said he was asked if there would be major changes before they voted it out. And he said, not major. Maybe minor to medium changes.
to medium. Okay. Are we cooking a steak here?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Medium rare changes.
Okay. So something's going to change, whatever that is. But Megan's frowning. She's like, I don't know what'll change.
I don't know. Remains to be seen.
So, but then the big part of this was the tax. Governor DeWine wanted to double the tax on recreational marijuana. This bill had the tax going, I think, from 10% to 15%. They just removed the whole entire tax portion and put it in the budget and said, we'll deal with it in the budget instead of this bill. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they took it out of the bill, but it's not necessarily because they want to keep issue two the way it is. It's because they're negotiating it in the budget.
So the tax still will probably increase. It just depends on how much they're going to negotiate that in the budget.
Right now, it would double the tax from 10 to 20%. And it would go to things like law enforcement training and just a whole host of issues. And this is in keeping with Governor DeWine's longstanding policy to kind of turn sins into virtues. You know, we'll take tobacco tax and we'll send it to like tobacco cessation problems. So if you guys want to do it, I can't stop you, but at least I can fund the things I want to fund with the taxes that we raise from it.
All right. And then, Danny, you also wrote about another issue that's kind of, I mean, related-ish, adjacent to marijuana is the word I want to use. You wrote about the issue of intoxicating hemp. It came up last week at a Department of Agriculture committee hearing. I guess, first of all, tell us what is intoxicating hemp, because now my understanding is that it's not regulated.
So no, it's not regulated. Hemp farmers can grow hemp, this is different from CBD. Intoxicating hemp is sent to a lab and synthetically, chemically altered to have to make it more like regular marijuana. The level of intoxication is very similar, but there's no age gate. Anyone of any age can go to a convenience store or gas station and buy these products.
It's also known as Delta 8.
Yeah, Delta 8
is how a lot of people know it.
It's known as, Delta 8. They're calling it intoxicating hemp, I think, because there are also different, it's not necessarily just Delta 8. It could be.
Okay.
I think they're trying to capture just THC in general. And it's interesting that they're doing it separately, want to do it separately in the Senate, because I know House Speaker Huffman, I asked him about it, and he told me that he wanted to do it together. He thinks, we should just deal with THC in general and just have a THC policy for the state.
The Division of Cannabis Control Superintendent, Jim, how do you say his last name?
Canepa.
Jim Canepa. He testified urging lawmakers to regulate it. What did he tell the committee?
Yeah, I mean, he is, very adamant that thing he regulates in cannabis and this intoxicating hemp is pretty much the same thing and should be regulated the same way.
So he's advocating for his department to have more to do.
He's also, I think, frustrated because, there are shops that sell these products that call themselves dispensaries. So he gets calls like, what are you doing about this dispensary? He's like, well, I don't have regulatory authority over that shop.
Oh, because if it's just a hemp shop.
Yeah, and they call themselves dispensaries. They advertise on billboards and on buses. He's been saying that that's another thing he's been getting calls about, and they don't have any authority over those kinds of advertisements either, even though they do in the regulated cannabis industry.
Infamously, the Department of Public Safety, Andy Wilson, who's the Department of Public Safety director, he sent his 15-year-old nephew and his friend to a gas station last year and to buy these products just to show how easy it is to get them.
A 15-year-old can just walk in and buy something that's basically the equivalent of marijuana.
Yeah, like a less potent version of bud, still has THC in it. So this is something they've been looking for to regulate for a while. And in addition to all the recreational marijuana regulations, too, but these have been on hold last session, mainly because of then-House Speaker Jason Stevens, who for reasons that were not fully made clear, didn't just completely walled off any bill from passing. And now that he is gone and that Matt Huffman is Speaker of the House, these bills are finally moving.
Okay. So, yeah, did you want to add something about...
Oh, I was going to say that Governor Mike DeWine, he's been really the one sounding the alarm bell on Delta 8 and has been really imploring lawmakers to introduce legislation related to this and pass it. And so he's very much in favor of this kind of regulations.
Do other states regulate hemp or Delta 8? Do we know?
It's a kind of a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. Yes, other states do. Not all. I can't remember the number off the top of my head. But yes, there are states with regulations.
Okay. Well, and before we run out of time, I wanted to move on to another bill, the transportation bill. Jeremy, you wrote about the transportation bill, $11.5 billion in a two-year transportation bill. The House Finance Committee made a lot of changes to it. What stuck out to you as being important in this transportation bill?
So the money itself was pretty straightforward, but they put all these policy things in there, too. And that's the thing that they really added. So they would require Ohioans that when you go into the BMV to vote, you would have to show proof of citizenship before you could do that. And that's designed to be another way to cut down on voter fraud, which is pretty rare in Ohio. But then, you know, the argument by supporters is, well, you know, any case is too much. Mm. So there's that. There's a controversial interchange proposal up in the Cleveland area that these two suburbs have been fighting over. And there would be basically a removal of a requirement to build that. There's something called enhanced driver's licenses, which are not real IDs, but different. It's designed to allow Ohioans to go into Canada and Mexico without a passport. And for curiously, 2 years ago, they made Ohio the sixth state to do this. Lawmakers did. And now they would roll that back. But there's also a bunch
they
of
want to
here.
Get rid of enhanced.
They
drivers.
Want to. Yeah. So they haven't been issued yet because they've been awaiting the federal government. They've been waiting for them to approve it. They haven't yet. But this would kind of, you know, cut it off before they actually issue it. But there's a couple of things that's interesting. For all that, there's been a lot of talk about now that Jason Stevens is gone, that Democrats are really up a creek in terms of getting their priorities passed. But if you look at this transportation budget, there's significant amount of Democratic priorities in here. Like there's $1 million to give private transit vouchers to low-income Ohioans. It would have Ohio rejoin the Midwest Interstate Rail Compact, which is...
Oh, right, trains.
For trains on passenger rail, not just trains.
No, really?
And it would give $50,000 towards that. That seems likely to end up in the final transportation budget.
So wait, how much? Only
$50,000. But I mean,
that's not very much
but
money.
That's just for the compact.
Okay.
But, you know, that's a needed step towards expanding passenger rail and bringing it to Columbus. And so there are things in here that are surprisingly bipartisan. Now, we'll see how many of them end up in the final version. Again, it's still early. But that's what I noticed in this budget.
All right. And the transportation bill, is it a part of the budget or is it a separate bill we're talking about?
Separate bill. There's two budgets that pass during budget season. Mm-hmm. Well, there's technically four, but the two big ones are the main operating budget and the transportation budget.
Okay. Okay. I don't think I knew that was separate, but now I know. See, I learned
it's
something
new. It's not intuitive.
Yeah. I learn something new every time Jeremy comes on the show.
And the transportation budget has to move earlier. It always passes first because to get it, you know, ready for construction season.
Yeah. Okay. It's in the right lane for the operating budget, left lane for the transportation budget.
Oh, are you going to give me a road pun? Nice. All right. We're down to 2 minutes left, but Danny, you wrote about bird flu, correct? Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So some of the frontline federal workers handling bird flu were either fired or laid off by the Trump administration. Ohio leads the nation in the number of cases of bird flu. What are you seeing in covering it lately?
So I know I'm director Ohio Department of Agriculture Director Baldridge testified on his budget proposal this week, and he was asked about that. And he said that there's some uncertainty there, but he's looking forward to talking to the new USDA secretary. I sort of forget her name. I think it's...
That's okay. That's
but,
okay.
But anyway, he wants to speak with her just to stay on top of that. Because bird flu is a huge issue here, and there's also been talk about this, funding in the state budget. I know the Ohio Poultry Association wants more funding for the lab work necessary to detect and test birds and make sure there's enough staff.
The Ohio Poultry Association testified before a committee saying that they need more money to combat bird flu and they need it more quickly because it's here right now.
Right. There's a slight increase in the budget for it, but he said that it's Jim Chakaris, the executive vice president of the Poultry Association, said that's not enough. But he'll come up. He didn't provide a specific number of how much it should be, but said he would come back to them shortly.
And Ohio is leading the nation in the number of cases. The number of egg-laying birds that have been destroyed has risen to more than 12 million to date. And there's only been one human case. But I guess this is something where there's both federal money and state money trying to help these farmers.
Yeah, and that's something where consumers are seeing at the store too. Eggs are more expensive and harder to find. I guess we'll see what happens with that.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for our reporter roundtable today. I want to say thank you. Thank you to Danny Eldridge, reporter for Hannah News Service. Thanks, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thank you, Megan.
Happy to be here.
And thanks to Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter at Cleveland.com. Thanks, Jeremy.
Hey, thanks, Amy.
And this has been the All Sides Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.